All right, everybody, shalom, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show here on thelandofisrael.com, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, where I am joined by Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom.
Oh, so great to see you.
It's great to see you. I haven't been here in a little bit. I was in San Fran.
Yeah, how was that?
You know what? Much, much grander and bigger and more of a gravitational center than I knew. Mm. Have you been to San Francisco?
Not for many, many years.
Okay, I didn't know that it was like such a thing unto itself.
It is its own world.
Right, its own. I didn't understand that. And basically, San Francisco is a little bit like Tel Aviv in the sense that it's not such a big city, but the region is very big, and that's called the Bay Area, Silicon Valley. I was in Palo Alto. I was in all that stuff.
Wow.
I was in Sacramento. And yeah, listen, it's a whole world and a whole pace, and frankly, for me, a lot to learn. And also, frankly, a place that is considered hard for pro-Israel activism.
It's the extreme liberal end of America.
Right. I think maybe it's more correct to say even that it's the capital of liberal ideas.
Fair enough.
And therefore, it's not even so that it's the wellspring of it. And so you're really dealing with a place that that has a lot of criticism on Israel, not a lot of excitement for Israel, and frankly, it's far away. It's far away from California. Is far away physically, also in terms of time. It's always kind of on the other side of Israel, almost always, with that 10-hour time difference. So, with all that, though, I got to meet still, wherever I went, I met pro-Israel people, good pro-Israel people, some good, some better, and always when you're out there, the incredible force of Chabad is apparent when you're out.
It is amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And also ideologically, I mean, talk about counterculture. In San Fran, the counterculture is Chabad.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, kind of wherever they go, Chabad is the counterculture, and that's one of their beauties.
Right, but in like places where I'm from, like Way, New Jersey, it's not like so much. It is a counterculture, but it's like it's a nice addendum. It's not contrary to the popular culture.
I hear you, for sure.
And here, like, we wanted to, you know, we felt we were on kind of a quote unquote, I'm saying this is with a smile, like on enemy territory in terms of understanding the rights of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, especially the quote unquote settlements. You walked into the Chabad, and there was pictures of the future Third Temple, and the rabbi there was like Chevron, where we'll hold on to it forever, and we understand the importance of it, and what could I do? It was definitely a bit of an island. Speaking of islands, this Torah portion, on the one hand, is a complete island within. We're on Spiritual Cafe, right? And that means that we're in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov. We're going to be talking about the Torah portion today, and the Torah portion is in the book of Numbers, the book of In the Desert, the book of Jewish politics, maybe, and Jewish leadership. And this week's Torah portion is an island unto itself. It's called Balak, and it's written mostly, 90% of it, from the point of view of the Gentiles, Gentile prophets, Gentile leaders, in inner Gentile conversations. And the Torah, in a sense, is like a fly on the wall, seemingly, where the Torah is generally the book of the story of the Jewish people, about the Jewish people. Here, the Torah is going to the mode of how the Jewish people look from the outside. So on the one hand, it's definitely an island of perspective in the Torah. On the other hand, I want to throw out to you, Rabbi Mike, as a first volley, the idea that in some ways, this Torah portion is not only not an island. In some ways, it's a pinnacle, maybe a kind of Torah writ large, a big perspective on Torah. Instead of the minutiae details of the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, here it's like, here's what it's really all about, and the prophecies that are going to come through the mouth of the evil prophet Bilam are really going to be the big story of the Jewish people.
You're a wizard, Harry. A wizard.
Well, it's an amazing camera shift that you noted. I mean, literally, since Moshe showed up in a basket in the reeds, we've been following him and his stand against Paro and the Exodus, and with him all of Am Yisrael. And then suddenly in our parsha, the camera literally shifts. Like you said, it jumps off of Am Yisrael and suddenly comes into focus on the worried Moabites and their chosen savior, so to speak, Bilam. Yeah, and I also hear what you're saying, that there is a grandeur to this parasha. And it, a lot of it comes from that shift of perspective. You're pulling back the lens and suddenly realize that all this whole drama, which has seemed very local and almost parochial up to this point, is a world drama. And it's the first taste we get of the world's role as almost a spectator, or a spectator is a little bit too arm's length, since they're very concerned.
I think it's a second time we see it, because we did sense at least that Egypt was concerned with God and with the Exodus, but there was more of a relationship between God, Moses, and Pharaoh. Here, it's like the Jewish people are coming to the land of Israel, and there's going to be a land fight. There, it was like, you know, over there, if speaking of the liberal perspective, there was only fair. It was, you know, an enslaved nation trying to get freedom. Here, it's about fighting for the land, in a local indigenous population being like, oh my God, here comes this nation. They're going to lick us up like the ox licks up the field.
So, I mean, sure, it was certainly only fair, but another way I would look at it is that Egypt, the Exodus, is a story of birth. No one questions the role of the mother in birth. I mean, she's there. Of course she's there. But who's that story about? Well, it depends on who you are. The mother goes on with her life and hopefully maintains a good relationship with the child. But if the child's going to live their life, there comes a point at which they're living the life in the context not just of having been born, but of choosing their life, of choosing the story, of finding the place where they will become themselves. And that's really, right at the end of last week's parsha, all right, the motion of Am Yisrael ground to a halt. And we're going to sit there. We're there at the edge of the Jordan River. We're going to sit there for the rest of the narrative of the Torah.
The rest of the Bible.
The five books of Moses.
Right.
Right. And so this is an important sort of, like I said, a shift in perspective to show that one of the reasons that God chose to halt the motion at this point is to give context to our eventual entry into the land. Right. And it's astounding what you said about like this being the pinnacle of the Torah in many ways, because I don't know if you're aware that the Gemara in Baba Batra gives a list of who wrote what books of the Tanakh. It's a list, by the way, that if you read it out in most yeshivot here in Jerusalem, they'd probably kick you out. But nevertheless, it's still there in the Gemara, so I feel safe mentioning that it says that Moshe wrote not only his book, presumably the Torah, but also Parshat Bilam. That he wrote his book and the portion of Bilam, which is incredible. What does that mean? I mean, isn't the portion of Bilam in his book already? I mean, here it's part of the Parsha. Why does the Gemara go out of its way to tell us that these words are actually written down by Moshe? So one answer is obvious, and we've already touched it, which is that this is a big skip to events that he was not personally participant in, and so therefore, don't worry, this wasn't like, you know, some editor that tacked it on. That's still Moshe. But I think on a much more profound level is that Moshe's task was to speak the divine experience from within Am Yisrael. Right? We say Moshe, that God's voice, so to speak, spoke through Moshe's throat. But here, what we're seeing is a revelation which can only come from outside. Just like there are things about myself that I can really only know if I sit with someone who can see me from outside. Now, those things are not always the most important, and they're not always definitive, but they are things which are not available to me. And that's what we're going to see in this parsha, that certain terms and names and characterizations that Bilam gives, which stay with Am Yisrael. I mean, I like to ask people sometimes, Jews, religious, educated Jews, who said, Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov? How goodly are your tents, O Jacob? I would say upwards of 80% of religious Jews get it wrong. They assume it was Moshe, right? And because they don't understand that Bilam is, so to speak, he's the anti-Moshe, right? He's the outside voice.
The bizarro Moshe.
The bizarro Moshe. And but the reason God doesn't just simply give those blessings through Moshe, but rather transforms Bilam's evil perspective, his distorted vision, into a source of blessing, is because there's still a core truth to be found here, is that you cannot be wholly yourself until you integrate how you are perceived from without into who you are truly are from within.
So that reminds me of the famous joke that media people all know, Jewish, pro-Jewish, pro-Israel media people know, which is that there's a young man, he's walking around one of the concentration camps during the Holocaust, and he sees an old man reading a Nazi newspaper, and he says to the old man, he says, "Old man, we have our own papers now. We have Hebrew papers, we have Yiddish papers, but we have our own papers. You don't need to read those Nazi papers." And the old man says to him, "Look, in our papers, we're sickly, we're being killed, we're infighting, we have problems. In their papers, in the Nazi papers, we own all the banks, we have all the money, we own the media, we have all the power. I'd rather read those papers." And I'm telling that joke in that exactly what you said before, which is we've dealt with a lot of parochial issues, a lot of infighting. It looks kind of messy. When you zoom in on the Jewish people, there's a little bit of ugliness, seemingly. Mm. When you zoom out, you see the big picture. And we'll get back to the issue of zoom in, zoom out, because it actually plays a central role. This Torah portion, Balak, is separated, one could say roughly, into three parts. The first part is the one when Bilam, this prophet, is on the road or trying to get on the road. He's being courted by the Moabites. He's being courted by them, the Midianites.
Balak is king of Moab. He joins up with Midian.
Right.
And they're the ones that actually give him the idea to go to Bilam.
Right. So we have this Moabite-Midianite
coalition.
And they're trying to reach out to this prophet, and they're trying to kind of seduce him with money and with other ways to come there. And finally, he's going to agree. God warns him, say only what I tell you to say. There's some confusion there, what God exactly wants. There's a lot of discussion about what God wanted Bilam to think. But in any case, he finally goes out there. Then there's the famous, we'll get back to it in a second, the scene of the donkey, which is he's on the way, he's riding, but the donkey sees this angel of God with a sword in his hand, stopping him on the path. And the whole relationship between Bilam and the donkey, the three times, the striking of the donkey, and finally the revelation. And this was all to kind of humiliate and also bring Bilam down to size a little bit. That's section number one. Section number two is going to be the interaction between Bilam and Balak and the three, really four prophecies that he's going to speak out and the meaning of those prophecies. And then camera shift towards normal Torah, which is we're going back to the Jewish people. And here, we've heard a lot of very beautiful things about the Jewish people being separated and being a unique people, a people that doesn't mix, it dwells alone. And yet, here come the Jewish people, and they start to mess around with Gentile women who also seduce them into idolatry and the emergence of a new hero, which is going to be Pinchas. Those are roughly three different sections. So let's start with section number one. Bilam is known to be by the world seemingly as a person who knows how to relate to God, and people think that if he curses something, it's to be cursed. He says, I don't really have any power to curse. It's really God's power. And yet we know that the way that Bilam really operated is that he was able to ascertain the moments of God's anger and to laser focus on that. Seemingly God gets angry for one moment in the day. And if you could just exploit that little moment, if you can needle that moment.
Every child knows the trick.
Right? You can get a rise out of God against his beloved. If you can exploit that what's it called in computer language? That weakness. The security
flaw.
Right, the security flaw, security breach. If you can exploit that. Finally he seemingly rushes to do this job of cursing the Jews, and he gets on his old she-donkey. And this old she-donkey, it has her eyes revealed. She sees an angel that God puts, an angel with a sword. This is a killing angel. This is an angel of war. Is on the path trying to stop Bilam. And the donkey reverses direction, goes into a wall, and then finally just crouches under fear. And the whole time we see this angry, not very kind, what's the word, kind of very...
Very willful.
Right.
He's driven by his desire. Because there's a tremendous tension that runs through this whole part of the parsha, which the commentators spend much time trying to unpack, which is, well, was he really wrong? I mean, because at first God told him, don't go. But then God says, well, if they're speaking to you, you can go. And then God sends him an angel, but doesn't show him the angel, shows it to the donkey. And the donkey veers off into the field and pinches his leg against the wall and lays down under him. And finally, when the angel finally reveals itself to Bilam, and he bows down and says, okay, I won't go. And the angel says, no, you do what you like. So what's being shown to us is the fact that this is Bilam's desire, right? And even though God is trying to shift that desire, what God is not willing to do is to stop him. Because there's a general principle that the sages teach us, and that in the direction in which one desires to go, that is the way in which he will be drawn.
You have free will.
You have not only have free will, but the world is responsive, right? And we can't always trust the fact that, hey, look, the path is opening up right before me. Seems to be that's what God wants. No, be careful. You always have to make a distinction between what you want and what God wants. Because sometimes God says, are you going to go that way? Okay, that's the way it'll go. That's not necessarily what I want, says God. I told you once, twice, I sent you the angel. I mean, I opened up the donkey's mouth and she told you not to go.
That's right, fool. Now I'm a flying talking donkey.
So, Rabbi Mike, we skipped one little step there, which is that the donkey itself opens her mouth and she says, hey, man, I've been your donkey forever, okay? I've done everything you've ever wanted. We've been together for a long time. Why are you hitting me? Do I deserve this kind of thing? And Bilam says, if I had a sword, I would have killed you right now. And you know what the irony is? Somebody has a sword. You don't have a sword. Mm-hmm. The angel has a sword. The angel has a sword, and you don't. You think that if you had a sword, you'd have power. You don't have power. The angel's got that sword, and it's God has got that power. That's number one. Number two is, why are you hitting your animal? It's drawing an image of a very, also a cruel man. That's the word I was looking for. There's a cruelty.
And a crudeness as well. You know, there's only two animals in the entire biblical narrative that speak. Bilam's donkey and...
And a snake.
The snake, right? Both of which speak about human nature. We'll leave the snake to the side for now. That's its own parsha, as they say, right? But there's something so deep in what's happening here is that there's something within Bilam that's holding him back. I mean, the donkey is the physical aspect of human nature that the mind and the spirit ride upon, so to speak. But at the same time, it's not always lowly and crude. There's a deep truth that our body can teach us. And like here, the donkey sees the danger ahead. You know, in a metaphorical sense, Bilam feels in his kishkas that this is not the way he needs to go, but his desire, his mind, his intellectual constructs are pushing him forward. And what's he doing? He's beating himself in order to get there. In the end of the day, what does he say? I'd kill myself if I could just to get to this thing I want. Even though that other half of himself that's been with him all along, right, is telling him, no, it's not the way to go.
That's interesting. That's a very interesting thought, and in some ways you're painting him as a human terms, that he's got this inner conflict. And to me, when I usually see this, I actually see when you first read this Torah portion, oftentimes you wonder where do they impute so much evil onto him. But this is one of the signs of his kind of inner cruelty, mm-hmm. where and also his inner lack of faith in God. It's not like, by the way, as I came here today. My radiator fluid just came out of my car right now, and there's a part of me that wants to like hit the car and hit myself and hit fate and say, I have a whole day planned.
How can you do this is
not right, and I'm now stuck in Jerusalem. I got to get to Hebron. Where, how am I going to get this fluid? I can't drive for 1 meter with, you know, and I want to hit everything, you know, because I had a plan. But my faith will have to tell me, and also remembering this Torah portion. By the way, here you see an example of how the Torah portion teaches us Musar, teaches us how to behave properly, teaches us to have faith in God. In this case, I have to say, and I actually said it to myself the minute it happened, I'm like, okay, my whole day is going to be totally shot, and everything that I planned is going to be messed up. But you know what? It's Mishamayim. It's from the heavens, and I'm just going to have to deal. I'm just going to have to go with the flow. I'm going to have to let it ride, or as they say in Israel, Tizrom. Flow with it, right? So in any case, but this shows that he wasn't able to do that. There was a cruelty in him. In any case, God reveals to the donkey and then subsequently to Bilam, this angel. And the angel is there to bring Bilam some humility. You are not the boss, and I don't want you. And God says, I don't want you to curse the people because they are blessed. That's right from the get-go. They are blessed. And you're seemingly going in a bad path. In any case, finally, he gets stage two is he's going to get to, before we transition from stage one, there's also the term the regalim, yes. The three pilgrimages, these three pilgrimages. Instead of saying three times, you've hit the donkey in three pilgrimages, and also the rabbis will mention the pilgrimages. They'll also mention the three forefathers.
Yes. I mean, the three forefathers. That's a little bit confusing.
The three... I don't like the word patriarchs because I've decided that we are not Greek Orthodox, so I don't talk about patriarchies.
No, yeah, but patriarchy has a bad name in the world out there today.
Yeah. I like to call them now the founding fathers.
Well, then the three founding fathers, I think, are mentioned here in order, as we see sort of a repeated theme, to understand that this is, as you noted, this is an epic struggle. This is not just a local phenomenon with some, small-time sorcerer who's been hired by a petty king to, like, push off some, you know, nomadic tribal people that are chewing up the edges of his land, right? That this is a fundamental struggle, and that every act matters. And so, therefore, the donkey having thwarted him not three times, but three regalim, right? These three periodic episodes that the Jewish people come into intimate contact with the divine, right, centered around Yerushalayim, is really to remind us that what underlies this whole conflict is the attempt of God to plant people in the land. That's what I see here. And there's many places of echoes of comparing Bilam to Avraham, right, specifically, right? And also the parallel, like we said, the bizarro Moshe. So I think that word is yet another anchor on which to hang the grandeur of this particular scene in the story.
So the story is big. It's about big issues, big themes. Funny, the Jewish people don't really know this is all going on, right?
Right.
We're flies on the walls on this one. The Jewish people at the time did not know about this great world drama. And sometimes you think to yourself, is right now somebody at the White House trying to sign away our land or trying to find a way to weaken our government or trying to, the V-15 and all that business? Are they, like, meddling, trying very hard to curse the Jewish people?
Well, you think about it, I mean, Lahavdil, but...
And certainly in Tehran and in Gaza City.
We'll step into history a little bit. Hitler appreciated the grandeur and importance of the Jewish people. It's a weird thing to say, I know, but this is a man who was bent on world domination, who in fact came as close as arguably anybody ever has, and he understood absolutely that in order to control the world, he must destroy the Jewish people, something which on the surface of it made no sense at all. And yet in the same way, Bilam is waking up to the sense that God has said, no, I don't need you. You can't curse them, number one. And then Bilam suggests, well, maybe I should bless them, and God says, I don't need you to bless them. They are blessed. That's the way it is. And so the revelation that he's about to experience, that ability to actually see the divine plan, is really in many ways a message to the Jewish people. Like, whatever you may be experiencing, like you pointed out, all this messiness and the details and the gritty politics and leadership struggles of the last chapters, don't lose sight of the big picture.
So now there's going to be an encounter between Bilam and Balak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the king and the prophet. They both have the same goal. Maybe one is more spiritually based. Like, meaning to say he wants to be the number one prophet in the world, and there's this whole prophetic gang that's competing. I like the image of the struggling wizard. That's the struggling prophet that you made before. In any case, but he's not that. And you have this king who also very much understands that fighting in a physical conflict with the Jews has proven ineffective. It's now been three wars, two against nations, Og, the Bashan, and the Cheshbon, and the Amorites,
Sichon, yeah.
Sichon and Cheshbon, and there's been already now wars. The Jewish people are winning. Certainly everybody remembers the exodus from Egypt. It's time for a different tactic. You got to give a little respect to Balak for understanding that the fight cannot be just on physical terms alone.
Well, I mean,
and by the way, why is the Torah portion named after him and not the real star of the show, which is Bilam?
That's an excellent question. And I think a lot of it comes down to what you just said, is that this whole Parsha is about how we're viewed by the nations. And the great insight that Balak has, which expresses itself negatively by reaching for Bilam, is that this is not a normal story. Right, that nomadic peoples have come out from the desert before, we fought them off, or perhaps we've absorbed them, or they took us over, but that what's happening here is fundamentally different. And I think that he represents that ability to look at Am Yisrael and realize there's something different happening here.
And yet in that is a tremendous evil, like a super evil. if you like just get annoyed with Jews and you just want to keep them as a slave nation or whatever, that's one level. But if you actually get it, that there's a super goodness that can come into the world through these people, and you want to crush down on that, first thing, it just means that you want to dominate with evil into this world, and also that you truly resent God. If you see God and you see the power and you still want to destroy it, there's something deeply evil in you.
Well, this is why the sages teach that a battle against Am Yisrael is a battle against God, for exactly the reason you said. If it was simply territorial or economic or any other reason, so then, okay, that happens in the world. These things happen in life. It's nothing personal. Right, this is about resources. But as you said, if you actually understand that Am Yisrael represents something new in the world, certainly at the time of Balak, and it's Davka specifically because of what they represent that you are rejecting them, then that's a fight against God himself.
I want to take a second and just thank the good people who are part of the show. Two listeners that I haven't usually mentioned, and it's very important to mention them. And one is Moshe Z. He was just in Israel hanging out with me, big listener to the show, along with our good friend Jack and Lillian and Sarah and Nathan, all the good folks. They were here in Israel on a big bar mitzvah tour, which was simply inspirational.
Yeah, I got to give them a big mazel tov at the Kotel.
And they were very, very moved by the fact that you were there, so they thank you very much. They helped the show happen, and I took part of that group to Hebron. And we got to really see the founding fathers and mothers and just to have an awesome connection. And in fact, I'm going to tell you a story about that right after I also mention Aaron and his mom, who are avid listeners to the show and supporters of the landofisrael.com network. Thank you so much. And thank all of you out there who are friends of the show. I know there's so many of you that are avid listeners and that I haven't mentioned in a long time. So you deserve a mention. Write me an email and with the following words: I am a listener. That's all. I am a listener. And if you write to me that and I know your name, I will do those shout outs and blessings to you from Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov in the heart of Jerusalem on the Land of Israel Network to the world. We're doing Bilam's work backwards. We're blessing the world through the Jews. And that's really our. Sometimes people bless me in the name of foreign gods. I take offense to that. I tell them, "Hey, I'm back after 2,000 years in my land, in God's great vision. Don't call names of other gods. Let me bless you in the name of the God of Israel." Speaking of that, I want to tell you a quick story, Rabbi Mike. You ready for a quick story?
I'm ready for a quick story.
All right. So we were in a synagogue in Palo Alto, which is not pronounced Palo Alto. That's just a little joke I make with my kids. All right, here we go. So in any case, I was in Palo Alto there, and somebody said to me, maybe it was you, one of my smart friends says to me maybe a month or two ago, they said to me, what is the aha moment in Hebron? I'm like, what do you mean? They said to me, and I work as the international spokesman of the Jewish community of Hebron, where the founding fathers and mothers are buried. In any case, they said to me, at the Western Wall, when you're at the Western Wall, you put in a note at the wall, you did it. The minute you stuck that note in the wall, that was the moment you did the Kotel. You were there. Or if you put both hands on the Kotel and you look up to God, like there was a ding that you hit. It's like, you did it. You did it. What is the Hebron moment? And I'm like, I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know what that is. That's a great question. And one of the problems with Hebron has got so much and so much history that you sometimes don't even know exactly what to connect to. But I didn't know what it was. There's no note in the wall. You do that in the Western Wall. Is it praying? Yeah, but really, if you really want to do prayer, the epicenter of prayer is in Jerusalem. So what is Hebron really about? What's Hebron really about? Any case, I'm in a synagogue in Palo Alto, and I'm looking at one of the panes of glass that surround the Bima, the center part of the synagogue, where the Torah is read, and it says the following verse. It says, "Hamalach Hagoyel Oti Mikol Ra Yivarech Et Ha'Ne'arim VeYikara Bahem Shemi VeShem Avotai Avraham VeYitzchak VeYidgu LaRov BeKerev Haaretz." The angel who blesses me and protects me from all evil will bless the children and will bless them in my name and the name of my forefathers Abraham and Isaac, and they will be blessed and multiplied like fish. And I realized that that's the thing about Hebron. Bless the children in the name of the fathers. Do it there. And when I was with this family that we just talked about, with Jack and Nathan and Sarah and Moshe. When we were there, I said to them, "Put your hands on the head of your child and say this verse. Sing it. Hamalacha goelote." Right, the famous song. V'shem avotai, v'shem avotai, Avraham v'Yitzchak. Like, bless them in the name of the forefathers and mothers that are right there, and send that blessing from the parents to the children. You pass it on right there in front of them, and that's the aha moment. Mm. And that was what I conceived of in my Shem, what Hashem put in my mind, and we did it. And it was exactly like that. It was exactly that feeling of like, ding, you hit it. You did the blessing.
Awesome. That's a beautiful idea, because what it is so much of what it means to be Jewish, and particularly in our time. Because what you're saying is that you're taking the power of the past and you're infusing it in the present moment, like that you know, aha moment, like you said, but it's about the future. You're putting it in the hands of your children, because we are people who knows our past and connects to our past, not because it's ancestor worship, that's not what's going on, but because we're living the present because we believe in the future. And that's what they wanted for us. It's a very beautiful, very beautiful idea.
So now there's this meeting between stage two of this Torah portion. Balak is that there's going to be a meeting between Balak and Bilam. And basically Balak is like, look, I need you to curse these people for me, all right? I believe in the power of spirituality. I believe in the power of higher powers. And you know what? I want to use it for evil. And can you please curse these people for me? And that will wilt them away somehow. They will fail. And they go up to three separate mountaintops, or three separate views. And in each one of these views, Balak says to Bilam, "I'm going to show you just the edge, just a small part of the people. And I'll take you around a mountain. If you've ever walked to the mountains, you understand what this is about. I'll take you to a mountain. You'll see a part of the people. You'll see them there down there in the valley. You'll see just the edge, and that'll be a perfect spot to like curse them." And he keeps on saying, "You'll see just a limited amount." This fits in exactly with what we learned about Bilam, is he knows how to exploit the small dark moment in God's day, and he knows how to see the dark side of the Jewish people by focusing and finding some fault, some weakness, some breach, and exploit that. And if you see the big picture, and that's what this Torah portion is about, the big picture of the Jewish people. If you see it, then you see the beauty of it, the majesty, the destiny of the Jewish people. Let me help you, says Balak. Let me help you find a way to curse the Jewish people by just seeing some characteristic that is negative, some moment that is negative, something ugly. By the way, just today I was watching an interview of Ayelet Shaked, the justice minister on Al Jazeera. And it's exactly what they were doing over and over again. "But you wrote on your Facebook page one time 3 years ago that all Palestinian children are snakes." That's what he said to her. "Is that true?" She's like, "No, that's not true. It's out of context." And he's like, "But is it true? Did you believe that?" He's trying to take one small thing and completely miss the picture.
And the phrase you just used, "out of context," is the major battle that we're fighting today. Right? This is a tool, by the way, that the intellectual inheritance of the West has really settled on, decontextualization. Right? It has its roots in literary criticism, which is not really worth going into what that means for now. But this is the power of being able to strip away the context within which a statement is made, or an action is done, or a people is at a moment in their history, and say, "Well, no, but I'll give you an example. I remember when I was in grad school, there were a number of students from Pakistan, right? And I often engage them in discussions about what's happening here in Eretz Yisrael. And what I found, my inclination is always to understand the history and the process and speak about where we were and how we've gotten to here. And every single one of them always say, no, I just want to talk about what happened in 1948. As if the world was born then. And the reality is there's a tremendous power for evil and distortion, which comes from showing a true thing out of context. And this is the battle that we're fighting today in the world. And the power of social media in particular is to isolate, elevate, and inflate incidents, words, images completely out of context and give them a disproportionate power.
That is exactly, we learned that here from the...
He was the master.
He's the master of that. He's the beginning of that. And in a sense, what the Torah portion says to us, this is a very powerful technique. It only because of God's intervention that it didn't work, but it had to be an intervention.
Well, because there is an inversion as well. I mean, I use this tool often when I'm struggling with my relationship with my children. Just focus on the good. Meaning sometimes there's a tremendous power of saying, I'm going to look at the one good thing I can think about today. I'm going to elevate that above everything else because I have an intrinsic belief that this child is good, and my experience right now is not necessarily reflecting that back to me. So I'm going to latch on, right? In like 10 minutes every day, I'm just going to speak about the good things, you know? And so we see here that it's essentially an amoral ability. It's not neither good nor evil. It depends on the purpose to which it's put.
Now, he's going to come out, he's going to go into some kind of meditative trance, Bilam is, after a pretty serious establishment of three altars.
Seven altars on all three times.
Seven altars three times, and animals, that's right, animals going to be sacrificed, a lot of animals.
Yep.
And I was thinking about that today. I was just trying to put that in my mind. You know, we read it very quickly, build me seven altars and, you know, sacrifice animals. Seven altars out in the mountains with a lot of animals. I think three animals on each altar.
There was an ox and a goat on each.
He says three and then later it's two. Okay. We're not going to get stuck on that, but the bottom line is that we're talking about a serious enterprise of
sacrifice
and also getting into that kind of mental and spiritual zone.
Sure.
It's like a meditative thing. We're getting into that. I'm trying to invoke, you know, spirituality and God, like a type of seance, let's put it that way, right? And then finally he goes into kind of retreat, reclusiveness, and he's going to come out, and here's going to be his masterful weaving of both some kind of dark energy, black energy, God energy, spirituality, some kind of knowledge in the ether, woven with his own parable and his own words. And he's supposed to come out with the curse of the Jewish people, and he comes out with these phrases. Now, if we would analyze every phrase here, it has tremendous meaning. But basically, the first set of blessings is he's saying what God, what you wanted to curse, God did not want. What you wanted to have anger, God did not have anger. And the famous phrase, "Hen am levadad ishkon," a nation will dwell alone. Uvagoyim lo yitchashav, and in the nations, it will not take account of the nations. And this famous phrase about the Jewish people being solitary, in some sense, is the first. I think the central phrase of the first grouping of blessings that came out instead of the curses.
And the question is what exactly that means. Because for most of history, we've understood this as, in its simple sense, a nation that dwells alone. If you think about, particularly when I teach my history course, I make the point that in the Roman Empire, the Jew was the indigestible element, right? We refused to become part of the Pax Romana, right? The whole Mediterranean basin was living in the Pax Romana, and we had not two, but three revolts against Rome, right? In the Christian world, we refused to accept the ideology.
What was the third?
The Kitos War.
Right.
During Trajan's attempt to beat the Parthians. That's actually, in my opinion, where the true deep Jew hatred arises, because Deo Cassius, the second century Roman historian, writes that the Jews boiled their enemies alive in their own blood, that they flayed their skins and used them for clothing, that in fact that the Jews were so evil that they were forbidden to land on the coast of North Africa for the rest of history. That gets recorded about the Kitos War between the Great Revolt and the Bar Kokhba Revolt.
Where does that happen?
Where?
It doesn't happen on the land of Israel.
Well, it's triggered here when Trajan makes his last attempt to break the Parthian Empire, which is to the east of us in modern-day Iran and Iraq, right? And therefore, the land of Judea was a critical staging ground for him. And apparently the revolt sparked here, but it truly burst into flame in Cyprus and North Africa and in Egypt and Alexandria.
Because that's not part of, like, Jewish common lore. We have the Great Revolt and the
Bar Kokhba Revolt.
Yeah,
and it shows up in various places in the Gemara. They mention it. And our primary historical source, like I said, is Deo Cassius. And I think it doesn't show up in Jewish lore because the description in Deo Cassius are literally blood-curdling.
Wow.
And he talks about hundreds of thousands killed.
That's interesting you say that, because the second prophecy, blessing, or attempted curse of Bilam's, the center phrase there, I think, is one of my favorite phrases in the whole Torah, actually, which is "Hen am kelavi yakum ukerit nasa," and yes, indeed, a nation will rise up like a cub, and like a lion, it will kind of rear itself. Lo yishkav ad yochal teref. They shall not lie down until they eat the hunt, v'dam chalalim yishteh, and the blood of corpses they shall drink. Whoa! That's not Woody Allen. That's not Seinfeld.
It doesn't go with my mother telling me that Jews don't play football.
Right. It's not with it doesn't go with any of that stuff. It's a very tough description of a nation who will not not only will they not succumb to enemies, but they are killers. You don't mess with these guys because they're not gonna, and even after you're dead, they're still gonna drink the corpse's blood. Like, whoa, that's not the Jew that I knew.
Well, listen, this is one of the big challenges that the Western world in particular faces today, which is that we've abandoned models of a healthy, positive use of force. Right? And this is perhaps...
Well, we have not abandoned them. They're trying to make us abandon them.
The West. That's why I said right. The West. I mean, I say we. Perhaps I shouldn't say we. I should say they. Right? And here in Israel, so much of the Zionist revolution was a re-embodiment. The whole movement is a re-embodiment. And therefore, to have a healthy sense of embodiment, one has to have a healthy sense of when the use of force is appropriate. And the West has abandoned that belief. And we here are struggling with trying to come to some medium. Because in the end of the day, and this is why I think the West has abandoned it, if you don't have a belief in justice, then there can be no healthy use of force, because it's only then used in the service of your own desires.
You can't have a belief in justice if it's all equal. If every justice, the only injustice there is on the individual level, and we all have total autonomy, and there is no one narrative, there is no justice inherently calls for some kind of single
standard
unity.
By which right. you can judge.
Right.
And that's, by the way, my understanding of that earlier phrase you mentioned, Am Levadad Yishkon, right? It's literally translated as a nation that dwells alone. We won't get into that question we raised already of why would you put a nation that dwells alone at the crossroads of the ancient world?
Right, and make them with a character that is fascinated by the Gentiles, is interested in the world. It is not an ashram dwelling.
From the time of Joseph, we've been mixed up in global politics, and it hasn't stopped since.
That's right.
But what's important to me is that word Yishkon, right? Yishkon is related to the word Shekhinah, to the divine presence, and to the Mishkan, right? That tabernacle which we built to receive the divine presence. Because in the end of the day, Am Levadad Yishkon is a people who dwells within. That our true sense of self lies within us. And therefore, that question that comes up, for how can we be this Yochal Teref Adam Chalim Yishteh? How are you drinking blood and fighting our enemies? The answer is because that relativism that the West has fallen into is because they're looking outside themselves for some abstract standard of justice, cannot find it, look within and say, well, I see this within me, but they see this within them, and what I think is right, they think is wrong, therefore everything is relative. Am Yisrael is meant to look within ourselves and say, no, this is right. And the fact that I see it within myself doesn't make it a subjective and therefore, weak standard. It's right because we know it's right. It's right because within ourselves we speak with God.
That's a very interesting take on it. I think that phrase, Am Levadad Yishkon, should be taken with the reality, as you're saying, with the reality that we're going to be mixed amongst the nations. So you have to have, as you're saying, basically, I'm just rephrasing it, which is you have to know that you have an inner standard or a truth. You're going to be mixed up with the nations.
Absolutely. An indwelling
But stay apart
people.
To some. But stay apart.
There's a beautiful uncles, right? The Aramaic translation from the rabbinic era of that line, where he says that these are the people that will inherit the earth. It says in Jeremiah that God will erase all the nations. So I would say for most of our history, we probably read that as like everyone's going to be destroyed and we'll be last man standing. But I think it's a mistake, because what it means is that the thing called right? How we organize individuals into a structure which can be reflective of values and vision, that Am Yisrael will be that last vision standing. And that humanity, of course, won't disappear. And individuals and all their beautiful diversity won't disappear. But what principle will organize it? That's going to be Am Yisrael.
All right, so our friend, or not such friend, Balak, is getting more and more frustrated. This is not what I brought you to do.
It's not what I paid for.
This is not what's in the contract. This is not our understanding. Okay, And Balak is going to be like, I told you, I can only say what God says. He says, listen, don't be literal with me. You know, and I know that I brought you here to curse. All right, one more chance. Let me bring you to yet another place where you will see but a smidgen, a small edge of the Jewish people. Certainly you'll be able to curse them from there. In other words, find a dark spot, find something to curse the Jews in. We're going to learn at the end of the Torah portion that indeed there is a weakness that's exploited, and it has everything to do with Am Levadad Yishkon, being a separate people. We'll get to that. In any case, in the last phrase, the last of the three official opportunities to curse the Jewish people, comes back Bilam with yet another blessing, of which one of the central phrases is Matovu Ohalecha Yaakov Mishkonotecha Israel. Oh, how goodly, as you said before, how goodly are your tents, Jacob, your dwelling places, Israel. There's a goodliness to when I see you guys all together, when you dwell together. It reminds us of the verse in Psalm 133, Hine Matovu Manaim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. How good is it and how pleasant it is to see brothers dwelling together. There's something beautiful in the dwelling of the Jewish people. Ohalecha is your tents. And Jacob, when Jacob, I think this refers to the diaspora. When it's Jacob, it's not Israel. We're in tents. That means that we're not in
permanent dwellings.
There's a beauty there. There's a goodness. And certainly when you are in rooted permanent dwellings, you're called Israel. There's nothing more beautiful than that.
And I think that the beauty of brothers dwelling together is the fact that the Jews are a tribal people, and there is a power of the very colored and individualistic tendencies, and yet the power which is available when those things can be harmonized and integrated into one people, into the camp of Israel, really, it just simply can't be matched.
So do you know how he shuts this down? This is a great verse in the Torah. He claps his hands. Balak, yes. He's like, he gives a big clap, and he's like, that's it.
Cut,
that's it, exactly. This is not working out, sir. It's just such a funny description. Yeah. He just gives us this clap, as though there has to be like something to break this muse. Mm-hmm. And he's like, and he senses that the channel, there is, by the way, something in this whole thing which is very media. Very broadcast.
Yes.
As a broadcaster, I could feel that this is, just like I told you some Torah portions ago when we talked about Korach, that my parents, coming from the Soviet Union, when they hear Korach's words, they're like, he's a commie. I know exactly who he is. Yeah. You know, I hear in this whole story the issue of broadcasting. And there's like something about this whole thing, the way it's like, the way you have to climb a mountain and you have to kind of send it out and you're channeling things and... there's something very Hollywood in this whole story, and in this case I think the cut is actually very accurate. There's like a cut. Like, I don't want you to keep broadcasting this stuff.
And then there's an epilogue.
Right. Well, here we go. Well, he says, "Oh, cut. Yeah. Listen, before I go, let me tell you. I'm going to tell you what you got to know. I may have blessed the people, but now I'm going to talk about the other nations." Oh, man, this is like candid camera. This is like reality TV.
It's the director's cut.
Right. It's the reality TV. He's like, let me tell you something, Mr. Director. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to you and all your friends. And he goes on to list what's going to happen at the end of days. Certainly, there are secrets here. In these verses, which we do not understand, and even if we did understand, we couldn't reveal it to you. But the bottom line is that there's no question that there's messianic end days prophecies coming here, to quote some of my friends. Certainly the verse, Darach Kochav Miyakov, a star will kind of fire or will make its way from Jacob. These are phrases that have something to do with the end of times. And also, he talks about the other nations and basically their destruction. He mentions here the arch nemesis of the Jewish people, Amalek, and he says, "Yeah, Amalek, you indeed are the head of nations." And right here, it calls into kind of the sense of how Germany was seen and sometimes still is seen as this like leading nation. And it says, "Yeah, you know, there's no question, you're Rashid Goim, you're number one in the nations, and yet Vacharito Adei Oved, your end will be destruction."
Right, and this is the parallel to the way Unkelus read Am Levadad Yishkon, meaning these are different models of what it means to be a people. And that model that we know that has brought so much suffering, right, the model for which all distinction and division is a cause of conflict, is headed up by Amalek. Right. And but the problem is that the illusion then appears that the solution is that everyone should be the same. But we as Jews know that that can't be true either, because we are meant to be different. So therefore, the model of peoplehood that we offer is a world of harmony where the distinctions remain, but they are all in service of a whole.
Mm. And this leads exactly to the next question. So Balak and Bilam part ways begrudgingly. And they all go back to their place. The show is seemingly over. Two epilogues. One is not going to be in this week's portion. It's going to be later on down the line. And that is that Bilam, the one who didn't have a sword, the one who finally sees a sword of the angel, is going to be put down by the sword when the Jewish people invade his area and basically kill him. Mm-hmm. By the sword, it says. He gets the sword. Although he has the power of the mouth, the power of prayer, the power of prophecy, at the end, he's run through by the Jewish people's physical, let's call it the IDF side of things. Not through a curse, and not through, they run him through. Is that the phrase, run him through, right?
Yes.
Right. So that's epilogue number one. But epilogue number two is in this week's Torah portion, also has to do with running through, and that is the following. Oh, how beautiful was the story. Oh, how powerful God is. And oh, how, you know, Matovu Alechekov, how beautiful are the dwelling, the tents, the dwelling places of Jacob and Israel, and how unique they are, and how pure and unmixed into the nations. But in the director's cut, right, in the full version.
Full feature version.
Right, the full feature version, which has some X-rated, or at least R17, whatever it's called, rated scenes, the Jewish people are starting to mess around big time with the daughters of Midian. And the word is, the Moabitesses, we got this thing from Moabitesses, and it says, Vayechel ha'am liznot et b'not Moav. The nation began to whore itself with the daughters of Moab. The daughters of Moab are attractive. They are seductive, and furthermore, they just tell you to, if you're gonna already, you know, if you've already broken faith, go all the way, and have some fun. Like, let it all go. Let it all hang out here in Woodstock, and just bow down to this little idol that I have. Or why don't you do some Baal Peor, which is the ultimate in some kind of like inner bacchanalia where you like defecate in front of an idol. Some people don't understand that. I understand that. I get it. It's like a full on, you know, just
full on degradation.
Right. Right. It's
like,
right,
you said, it's a complete descent into physicality, and therefore manifests itself in expressing all desires.
Right. And you want to hear the deep truth? There's a different. The sexuality in the Jewish realm is one of the most beautiful English words, procreative.
Yes.
It's about creation, creativity. Even the bond, the family bond is creative. Mm-hmm. And of course, bearing children, that's creative. Here, instead of sexuality that is creative, it is about lasciviousness, about self-indulgence. And it is equaled by a sensation of defecation, i.e. not the beginning of a life-giving process, but the end of it. It's totally about pleasure-seeking and has no procreative aspect.
It's because znut, that word that you noted before, is faithless and non-committed desire. Meaning Judaism embraces the fact that the human being is driven by desire. And in fact, we don't just embrace it. I think that we cherish that fact of life. But as you said, it's placed into that procreative context. It's a context of commitment. That desire can be a tremendous source for life and growth. And even though, it always has its gray areas. When it's within that procreative context, its commitment allows it to give life. Whereas znut, by definition, lacks any context of commitment. And therefore it just allows desire to go free, and therefore it ends up ultimately as a rejection of the physical because it's degrading. and therefore the body has to be, you have no commitment to your body and into the continuation of generations and to the wholeness of a family. No, I'll prove it to you. You know what your body is? This is what it is. It just generates waste. That's where everything goes in the end. Why are you telling me that any of this physicality matters? Like it's all one thing. You know, you see where it goes.
Excellent. That's exactly the feeling that I wanted to bring out. That's exactly correct. And that's not enough. It's not enough. And now think of some of the parades that we see today, the sexuality parades that we see out there in the world. It's not enough to do it in a tent. And the whole aspect that you just described, I'm not going to go into it again. But to do that, at least behind closed doors, no. Here there's going to be also a level of exhibitionism. This is normal. You have to accept this. This is the new way. It's a public thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're all into this. You accept it as normal. Not only live and let live. It's not like let me do my thing. No. I want you to say it. Say it's good. Say it's normal. I want you to accept this thing. And so a prince of Israel will take a Midian princess and have very public lasciviousness, and it's an exhibitionism. It's sexual exhibitionism. The Talmud describes it, and I think Masechet Sanhedrin in very again
graphic details,
and interestingly enough, why you might think that sometimes religion will kind of put a more pure and more subdued. No, they go into the amount and the publicity of it, you get the real feeling like this is a Greco-Roman and even maybe even in a higher level of just sexual exhibitionism, and the God says it's time to kill the people who are involved in this kind of stuff. Moses will direct the Jewish people to kill anybody who's involved in Baal Peor. But this public display puts even the great ones in a broken place, that Moses will be crying and the leaders will be crying. They'll be, and that's also, by the way, the tears is to mimic another excretion of the body. There's defecation, there's obviously the sexual act, but here there's like, it's so painful that there's going to be tears streaming out of this tzaddik's eyes. And the Jewish people, they cannot deal with their brothers going to such a degraded place and so publicly and such a challenge. Again, this is a political tract here, this book, such a challenge. And here comes a new hero, and it's going to be Phinehas, Pinchas. And he's gonna come in secretively, surreptitiously, and he's going to come in, no, not surreptitiously.
And he comes quite boldly.
Right.
No,
but he comes actually, no, it's not quite, no, he, there is a hidden aspect to the way he sneaks in, kind of a little, it's a little bit hidden, and then he's going, all right, whatever. In any case, it's certainly going to be bold, as you're saying, he's going to run through these two, the princess and the Jewish prince, and he's going to carry them out as he runs them through their reproductive organs. And it's going to show the whole nation
exactly what's going on.
Whoa, what is that all about? And of course, there's also, I have to say, a kind of phallic imagery here where there's a kind of...
The spear is the oldest phallic
symbol. Right, the spear. And harken back to the swords of the angel and the sword that Bilam didn't have. Here, the Jew, a zealot, has the sword, runs the whole thing through. And God will say, this Pinchas... He has been zealous. He has had my anger. He embodied, and I give him the covenant of peace.
Well, hold on a second.
Go.
Because that covenant of peace we need to discuss next week.
Okay.
And the beauty of it is that this is where the media element that you noticed in our parsha becomes so strong. Because this week's portion simply ends with him killing Cosby and Zimri. And this is one of the places...
Did you say the Bill Cosby show?
No. this is where you can see the power of the influence of the oral
Zimri
Torah.
Is the prince of Shimon, and Cosby, she is the
Midianite princess, right? But this is where you can see one of the most concrete expressions of the power of the oral Torah over the written Torah. Because you know what? So much in how you tell a story is where you begin and where you end. I mean, they didn't touch the text at all. They simply made a decision that this week we're going to end in that moment where the spear runs through.
Right.
And everybody, it's a cliffhanger. Everybody's going to leave shul. And you know what question they're going to be holding was? Was that a good idea or not?
Right. Was that the right thing to do?
Was it the right thing to do? Because there's a deep question in this. And I want to leave the full discussion of it until next week and what good. That breach shalom, that covenant of peace really is.
Right.
But for now, we're left walking out of shul. Everyone's going, oh gosh, what's going to happen?
Right.
I mean, for all we know, God's going to punish Pinchas. We don't really know. I mean, granted, we did read it last year. But the idea is we're left hanging because you need to sit with this. You need to sit with it for a week until this time next week.
You know, you're so right. You are so right. That's exactly how the show has to end. The show can't end with we had this great prophecies for the Jewish people. If it ended right there, it would be lame.
That's right. There needs to be tension, right. And it needs to leave you thinking, because the reality is, as you pointed out before, that this is a book of leadership, and leadership is never simple. Leadership is never about archetypes and easy decisions, right? And this is one of the great moments of leadership that the Jewish people experience in the desert, and therefore, all of us, for the rest of history, need to contemplate. Was this the right thing to do or not? And it'll only be next week that we hear God's voice.
All right. That's awesome. That's perfect. And I'm very glad that I actually knew in my heart that we would have to dedicate an hour to today's show because these things touch so much of our lives today. And I really do believe that there's an element of this Torah portion, which is actually maybe one of the pinnacle Torah portions in the Torah in terms of understanding our role today. And in terms of understanding Israel within the nations, and certainly many listeners to this show are from the nations, and it's time for us to go. We're going to leave you with that cliffhanger. Folks, I want you to write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Connect to me on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, whatever you want. I'm there for you. Don't tell me you weren't able to reach me, because that's just not true. Rabbi Mike, sulamyakov.com. Check out also Rabbi Mike's history podcast. You can be involved in that. It's all at sulamyakov.com.
You can also find me on Facebook, Rav Mike Foyer.
Rav Mike Foyer. Perfect. Great. And if you can't figure all that out, just write me an email and I will connect you with Rabbi Mike. And with that, folks, we leave you for an amazing Shabbat, an amazing light for the Jewish people from Jerusalem. There's a great tension there, an amazing nation that sometimes succumbs to the most basest things. What will bring us out of it? We'll find out next week. Shabbat shalom to all of you. Stay tuned, stay strong, and stay connected. And blessings from Jerusalem.
Rabbi Isaac Nissenbaum, one of the founders of the religious Zionist Mizrahi movement, wrote, "The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of our nation in all its aspects, to revive Judaism in our hearts and to revive our hearts for Judaism. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement."
Do you like picking strawberries or blueberries in the spring and summer? What about grapes? If you were to take an experience like picking grapes and move it to the heartland of Israel, this is when an experience becomes prophetic. Young and old, singles and families are all invited on this adventure of a lifetime. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to join us on the mountains of Israel, where prophecy meets reality. Go to hayuvel.com, that's HAYOVEL.com, for more information.